little bit behind schedule, then my goal is to get us caught up by the end of the night, which means we only have 6.5 articles of the Constitution to cover, but we have a whole hour in which to cover them. And looking at the clock, I see it is running right now. I reminded of the pastor one time, a visiting pastor in a church, who made the statement to the congregation, "I'm sorry if my sermon has run over a little bit, but I don't see any clock around here anywhere, and my watch has stopped." Somebody in the audience said, "There's a calendar behind you." And I hope it won't get quite that bad. We have been in Article 1 of the Constitution, and there we've been looking at the powers that we the people, through the Constitution, have delegated to Congress. And we looked at these powers as they're specified in Section 8. Now let's move on to Section 9. Section 9 simply is a statement of specific limitations on congressional authority, and there's a much broader limitation, which is that Congress can do nothing other than the powers that are delegated to it. But here are some specific things that were included primarily because of controversies at the convention itself. First is that Congress may not end the slave trade until the year 1808. Now, there was a controversy among the delegates to the convention about slavery, and just as there was in society as a whole at that time, and several of the northern delegates belonged to abolition societies, and actually there were probably more abolition societies and society members in the South at this time than there were in the North. But slavery was more common in the South, primarily for economic reasons, than it was in the North at this time. And so the debate over slavery consisted of the southern states, where several delegates insisted that slavery was a divine institution, and then those who believed that slavery was an abomination and should be abolished, and then you had some of the middle delegates, particularly from Virginia, who took a middle position. Thomas Jefferson said that he was opposed to slavery, and yet he was a slaveholder. George Washington also said he was against slavery, and yet he owned slaves, but he directed in his will that they be emancipated. Patrick Henry said that, "How can it be that I, a professing Christian, own slaves of my own purchase?" And he went on to say that given the economy at the time, it was impossible for him to set his slaves free. They'd have no way of supporting themselves. So he said, "I can resolve only to treat my slaves as generously and kindly as possible, and to work and pray that the day will soon come when this abominable institution will be abolished from the face of the earth." James Madison had said that the entire Bible is against slavery. And yet, due to the conditions of the time, he himself was a slaveholder. And so one of the controversies at the convention then was, what do we do about slavery? And particularly, the question came up since we decided that we were going to have a two-house legislature, as we discussed earlier today. And one of those houses is going to be based on population. So if we're going to base our membership in the House of Representatives on population, do we count slaves as part of the population? And the South said, of course we do. And the South said, no, we don't. Or the North said, no, we don't. And then what about taxation? When the idea is it's going to be a per head tax based on each individual, do we count slaves as people for taxation? And there the South said, no, we don't. And the North said, yes, we do. And so the argument went back and forth. In fact, one northern delegate even said that if the South is going to count slaves as people for purposes of determining how many congressmen they get, then we in the North ought to be able to count cattle and horses because they do the work up here that slaves do in the South. And so they reached this raw compromise that for purposes of taxation and for purposes of representation in Congress, a slave would count as 3/5 of a person. Now, nobody was saying that slaves were only 60% human. It was simply a raw compromise to get over that issue. Had they not done so, the Constitution probably would never have even been completed, let alone ratified. But also there was the question about the slave trade. And this is not whether or not you can buy and sell slaves in the country. Slavery, in fact, continued in Washington, D.C. until well into the 1850s, and not very long before that, there was a block there right within full view of Congress where slaves were being bought and sold. But when we talk about the slave trade, we're talking about the importation of slaves, which, I might add, was done primarily by the New England shippers. But the delegates from the South had argued that it would greatly affect our economy if we couldn't continue to import slaves. But they said further that slavery is dying out. It simply isn't profitable anymore. It won't be in a short time. And if you just simply leave this issue alone, slavery is going to die out on its own within about 20 years. And so they reached a compromise with some protection for the South here, in which they said that the slave trade could not be ended until 1808. That's about 20 years after when they assumed the Constitution would probably be ratified. Again, nothing but a raw compromise. Congress cannot suspend a writ of habeas corpus, except in time of emergency or war. Writ of habeas corpus was simply a petition that said, "Give me my corpus or give me my body," meaning either show good cause for holding me in jail or set me free. And where there was no other provision of law by which a person in prison could make an argument, the writ of habeas corpus was kind of the all-purpose writ that was designed as the writ of last resort. Congress further could not pass a bill of attainder. Now, a bill of attainder is a legislative declaration of guilt. The idea here is we have a separation of powers. It is the responsibility of the courts to determine whether or not somebody is guilty of a crime and to impose punishment, such as loss of citizenship. The Congress has no authority to do so, and so we see that prohibition. They cannot pass an ex post facto law. Now, an ex post facto law is a law that makes something illegal after it is done, but it's a little more complicated than that. It gets that way as you get lawyers involved, and they think of all these little points to argue about, and I know that there's a lot of anti-lawyer sentiment, and my answer to that is that people should not be telling lawyer jokes for two reasons. One, lawyers don't think they're funny, and two, other people don't think they're jokes. But one of my best friends always has a favorite joke that he uses when he introduces me for a speech. He says, "You know what's black and gold and looks great in a lawyer?" And his answer is a Doberman. But I keep telling him that Dobermans don't bite lawyers, and the reason is professional courtesy. But a writ of ex post facto is something more than that. First of all, first kind of writ of ex post facto bill would be a bill that makes something illegal, and then you're prosecuted under it after you have done it. Let's say that marijuana is legal, which quickly I say it is not, but let's say it's legal. You smoke marijuana, and some policeman sees you, and next month a bill is passed that makes marijuana illegal, and so they try to prosecute you for what you did back when it was legal. That can't be done. It is ex post facto. But several other things that are ex post facto are increasing the status of an offense or increasing the punishment for an offense after it is done. For example, right now, marijuana possession is a misdemeanor, and you're caught smoking marijuana, but then between now and when you go to trial, the legislature changes it and makes it a felony. They can do that, but they still have to charge you and try you under the old law where it was a misdemeanor. Similarly, if the maximum punishment is increased, or if the rules of evidence are changed, making it easier to get a conviction. Any one of those things, if they tried to apply that to you retroactively, would be considered a ex post facto law and therefore unconstitutional. Direct taxes have to be in proportion to the people in the census, and here's what you might find interesting is that where the Constitution speaks about an enumeration, it calls it that, an enumeration. It doesn't call it a census. And we have a census right now that asks all sorts of questions about how many bathrooms you have in your house and your nationality, your race, and all sorts of questions like this. The Constitution doesn't use that term, census. Now, the founders were familiar with Roman law, and they knew that under Roman law there was a census that asked all kinds of questions about property valuation and things, but they didn't use the term census. They used the term enumeration, and I think they did so for a purpose. I think census officials have a right to ask you how many people are in your household, and that's entirely appropriate. Beyond that, I'm not sure they have authority to ask for further information beyond that. Okay, there are certain limitations on state authority as well. One of those is that states may not enter into treaties, alliances, or confederations with other nations or with each other. And there are certain types of economic agreements that can be made that are exceptions to that, but that is your basic rule. Likewise, they can't pass bills of attainder or ex post facto laws. They also can't issue letters of marque and reprisal. Anybody know what a letter of marque and reprisal is? Yes, sir. Okay, and usually it applies to acts on the high seas. It's a letter that authorizes the captain of a private ship to seize enemy vessels. Again, I like to canoe, and I've been trying to get the governor to issue me letters of marque and reprisal so I can plunder motorboats on the Alabama River and supplement my income a little bit, but so far they're not very interested in granting me that power. I guess they're afraid of me. The states may not pass laws that impair the obligation of contract. Framers believed that contracts are semi-sacred, and that the right to make a contract with another person and to enforce the contract in the courts was one of the most important of our economic rights. Now, this becomes modified by a Supreme Court decision, Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell in the 1930s. At this time, we have a depression. We also have drought in the Midwest, and a lot of farmers particularly are going under financially and are having to lose their farms and their homes. And so the state of Minnesota passes a Minnesota Mortgage Moratorium Act that forbids mortgage companies, banks and the like, from foreclosing on mortgages when the farmer or other homeowner is not able to pay the mortgage. And the idea was you'll eventually get your money. In fact, you probably get more because interest will continue to accrue. But in the meantime, the person cannot be deprived of his property and can't be thrown off. Well, the problem is, and essentially what the court said in this case, is that a requirement like this didn't cancel a mortgage. It simply delayed its enforcement, and therefore it was reasonable. But Article 10 of the Constitution does not say that states may not unreasonably impair the obligation of contracts. It says they may not impair the obligation of contracts, period. And what if it were the other way around? What if it was the Minnesota Mortgage Acceleration Act? And let's say the banks were having an especially hard time, and so we pass a law that says that banks are now authorized to make you pay a double mortgage payment instead of just the regular mortgage payment you're making now. And after all, you're not going to end up paying more in the long run. In fact, you'll pay less because it'll be paid off sooner. But if they were to do that, that would produce a rebellion. People would say, no way. Well, the banks should have the same authority in this area and being treated by the law as should private individuals. Well, anyway, that gives you a few of the limitations that are placed on the Congress and some limitations placed on the states. And with that, I think we better move on to Article 2. And again, Article 2 deals primarily with the presidency. It begins by saying that all executive power, that is, all enforcement power, rests with the President of the United States and his executive department. It says the President shall serve for a 4-year term, but it places no limits on how many terms the President may serve. In fact, originally, when this was presented in Congress, it said that there was to be a 2-term limit. But Madison, in his notes, observed that George Washington, chairing the convention, voted against that limit. And even though Washington, chairing the convention, did not usually take sides on things, it was observed that he had such respect that a simple look of approval or disapproval on Washington's face was often enough to pass or defeat a proposal. And as a result of that, and in deference to Washington, and on the supposition that Washington was probably going to be the first president, when it came to the final draft of the Constitution, the 2-term limit was left out, and there was no limit in how many terms a president may serve. But Washington himself served 2 terms, and then he said that no one should really serve more than 2 terms. You become too despotic if you do, too much like a monarch, and there are too many advantages of incumbency. And so a tradition was established that presidents would serve only 2 terms. And that tradition continued up through 1940, in which time President Franklin D. Roosevelt, when the country was in the midst of depression and also on the brink of war, announced that he was going to break tradition and run for a 3rd term. He did so and was elected. In 1944, he was elected to a 4th term, although it was much closer, and he died in office a few months into that 4th term. And by this time, there was some general agreement that maybe the idea of a 2-term limit was the way it should have been all along, and so shortly after that, we see the 22nd Amendment, which is finally ratified in 1951, which limits the president to 2 4-year terms. Then we see the way of election in sections 3 and 4. Those elections there are done through what we call an electoral college. Now, the Electoral College does not have any graduates, and it's not an accredited institution where you can get a degree. Rather, it is a gathering of electors from each state by which the president and vice president are chosen. And although originally they would actually meet somewhere and cast their votes, today they usually cast them from their respective state capitals and don't really actually get together in one national assembly called an electoral college. When you vote for president, technically you're not really voting for the presidential candidate. You're voting for electors, people who your candidate's party has chosen, who will go to the electoral college and represent you there and vote as they are sworn to vote. And each state has electors. Those electors are equal to the total number of senators and congressmen from each state. In other words, each state then will have 2 senators, 2 electors based on that, and at least 1 congressman. And so this does give something of an advantage to the smaller states, because no matter how small a state is, it's going to have a minimum of 3 electors, and a state with twice the population will have the same number of senators and maybe 2 congressmen, so they'll only have 4 electors. So it does give some advantage to the smaller states, but some would argue that's necessary, because otherwise the candidates would simply ignore the smaller states. Personally, even though there are proposals to eliminate the Electoral College and It seems like any time there's a close contest that the losing party wants to eliminate the Electoral College and go to direct popular vote. I personally favor keeping the Electoral College, partly because it means the states still do have a role to play in the selection of the president, and partially because it does give the smaller states some extra protection that I think they need. Now, as we go on to look further here in Section 1 and Clause 5, we notice that there are certain qualifications for president. And some of you are going to be probably getting married before too long and having children. And if you do, I strongly recommend that you use the Lamaze method of natural childbirth so your child could grow up to be president. Because look what it says. It said, the president must be a natural-born citizen. And that is interpreting it a little more literally than even I would. And he must be at least 35 years of age and a resident of the United States for at least 14 years. We also see provisions for presidential succession. Now, shortly after Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992, and before he took office, he was at Monticello, Jefferson's home in Virginia, where he spoke to a group of high school students, and one high school student asked him, if Thomas Jefferson were alive today, would you appoint him to a cabinet position, and if so, which one? And President-elect Clinton answered, if Thomas Jefferson were alive today, I would appoint him Secretary of State, and then Al Gore and I would resign so Jefferson could become president. Problem is, the commander-in-chief didn't know his chain of command. Up until 1967, that would have been correct, but he has taught constitutional law since that time, and he should have known better. As presidential succession is established today, with the 22nd Amendment of 1951 and the 25th Amendment of 1967, if both the president and the vice president die or are otherwise unable to serve, the president then is who? Speaker of the House. And if the Speaker of the House cannot serve, pray that she can't, then the next step after that would be whom? President pro tem of the Senate. And if he's unable to serve, then it goes to cabinet officials in order of seniority. And seniority does not mean how old they are or how long they've served. Seniority means how long that has been a cabinet position. The first cabinet position to be established was Secretary of State, so the Secretary of State would be the next in line after that. We go on here in Section 1 to establish the compensation for the president and the oath the president is to take that he will preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And George Washington, when he took that oath, added the words, so help me God. And that became a tradition that every president has followed since. The powers and duties of the president are set forth then in Section 2. He is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and we've already seen that there is power over the armed forces by Congress. Congress raises and supports armies, they provide and maintain a navy, they make regulations for the governing of the armed forces and the like, but the president is the commander-in-chief. And essentially what this means is that the Congress sets the long-term policy for the armed forces, while the president and those who serve under him, like the Secretary of Defense and the Secretaries of the various services and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Chief of Staff of each of the branches of the service, that they will set the day-to-day policies and give the day-to-day orders for the armed forces operation. Now, we've already seen that Congress has the power to declare war, but that the President is the Commander-in-Chief. And so, we have had a conflict in Iraq for a number of years now. Congress in various ways has authorized that. but they have never actually declared war. So is this a legal war? Well, you'll notice here that Article 1 said that Congress has the power to declare war. But it doesn't say that the President can conduct no hostile actions whatsoever without a congressional declaration of war. Where does the President's power to commit troops end, and where does Congress's authority take over? Still a very open question. In 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, and the War Powers Resolution was passed over a presidential veto, and no president, Democrat or Republican, has accepted the validity of the act ever since. There have been various challenges to the act's constitutionality, but each time the court has found an excuse to duck having to make a ruling on it. But the act is in effect, at least, until it's declared unconstitutional. And essentially, the War Powers Resolution says that the president may commit troops into hostilities or into situations where hostilities are imminent for a period of up to 60 days. And after those 60 days, then if Congress has not either declared war or in some other way authorized the president to continue, he has to withdraw the troops. However, it further says that if he cannot safely withdraw the troops at the end of that 60 days, he has up to an additional 30 days to do so. And he can always say that, so practically speaking, the president can commit troops up to 90 days without some form of congressional authorization. I have to say that I think the authority of the War Powers Resolution, I think the intent behind it, was a legitimate good faith attempt to put into effect what the Constitution says. Whether they succeeded in that might be decided someday if the court ever gets a case that they decide to hear. The President, as we can see also in this section, also has the power to pardon offenses, and there are some reasons for this. Partly, it is a check and balance upon the judicial branch of government. Partly, it's a matter of combining justice with mercy. Sometimes, it's a matter of trying to ease domestic tensions and the like. In fact, Alexander Hamilton said that that's one of the reasons for this. And when President Ford, shortly after taking office, pardoned President Nixon, he was widely criticized for this, but it probably did have the effect of putting Watergate behind us and letting the nation move on. And I think there's been more of a consensus of that than there was at that particular time. And it occurs to me, I'm talking about something that happened around 1974, and one of the signs that you're getting old is that you teach history. And most of the stuff you're teaching is stuff that you remember happening. I'm going to tell you another sign of getting old, and that's when you're on an airline, and the airline lands, and you get up to get your overhead luggage, baggage out of there, and a pretty young girl comes up to you and smiles sweetly and says, "Do you need help with that luggage, sir?" No. Okay, so we see some of his powers then. He has the power to make treaties, but any treaty the president makes has to be confirmed by the Senate, and it has to be confirmed by a two-thirds vote of the Senate. He has the power to appoint justices of the Supreme Court, to appoint ambassadors, to appoint cabinet officials and other high governmental officials, but these too have to be confirmed by the Senate, but these only by a simple majority vote. And further, the Constitution provides that Congress may authorize the President to appoint lesser officials without having to get the Senate confirmation on their appointment. In other words, he doesn't have to get congressional approval every time we need a new secretary in the Department of Agriculture. for cabinet officials, sub-cabinet officials. It appears these are being considered high-level offices, and Senate approval is required. For anything below the level of sub-cabinet, usually we're saying that Congress can authorize that the President bypass the Senate in those appointments. He has various ceremonial duties, like giving the State of the Union address and receiving ambassadors and the like. He can recommend legislation, but he still has to get a senator or congressman to sponsor it. And then we see his power concerning impeachment. And if I had asked this question of law students, as I often did, let's say 20 years ago, I would get a very different answer from what I get today. But has the United States ever impeached a president of the United States? The answer to the question, as you say, is yes, even though he wasn't removed. Most people prior to the Clinton activities would have answered this question no. They would have said, we tried to impeach President Andrew Johnson, whose home is very close here, and we got to see it several years ago. It's very much worth your time. If you haven't already done so, that's a part of history that a lot of people have forgotten. And there was an attempt to impeach President Nixon. He resigned in the face of what was likely to be impeachment. Was Clinton impeached? Yes, he was. See, impeachment, as it is used in the U.S. Constitution, is an action by a majority of the lower house to impeach the president or other official. But impeaching doesn't mean removing from office. You might say that impeachment is kind of like indicting somebody. And after the person is indicted, then it goes for trial to the Senate, and the Senate decides whether to remove the person, and a decision to remove a president or other government official from office has to be by a two-thirds vote. Majority of the House voted to impeach Clinton, but of the Senate, on two charges of impeachment, one, the Senate blocked 50-50, and they needed 67, and on the other, it was a little short of 50-50. In the case of Andrew Johnson, the vote to impeach from the House was a majority. In the Senate, the senators seeking impeachment or seeking removal were one vote short of the necessary two-thirds. And so he was not removed from office. It was that close, but we're told that there were several other senators who had said that they would vote against removing him from office if their vote was necessary to prevent it. Okay, so that gives us some of the details about the president, and now let's move on to Article 3, the judicial branch. Here we read that all judicial power is vested in a Supreme Court and in such lesser courts as Congress may from time to time establish. As we noted this morning, Congress can vote to establish federal district courts, U.S. courts of appeal. If they want to put in another level of appeals, Congress can do that by legislation. If they want to eliminate the courts of appeal and provide that all appeals from the district courts will go directly to the Supreme Court, Congress can do that. Congress can set out the districts of the various federal district courts and the districts of the courts of appeal. The most liberal circuit in the United States today is the Ninth Circuit. Although it might surprise you, the Ninth Circuit wrote an excellent opinion just recently on the phrase under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and very pleased about that. There are conservatives on that court, and sometimes when they pick a three-judge panel, they will be a majority. But suggestion has been made that maybe they ought to divide the Ninth Circuit into two circuits. One circuit being a more liberal circuit consisting of the coast states, California and Oregon and Washington, the other the more conservative mountain states, Utah and Idaho and those states, And that's up to Congress. They could divide the Ninth Circuit anytime they wanted to do so. Now, we read that judges shall hold office during good behavior. Now, we read further concerning impeachment, that impeachment can be for only treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. That applies to federal officers except for members of Congress. Members of Congress have to be removed by their respective houses. Remember, it said in Article 1 that each house has final authority to discipline or remove its own members. But President Clinton noted during the impeachment proceedings that a number of judges, federal judges, had been impeached and removed from office for offenses that were very similar to the ones he was charged with. But he said a Supreme Court justice or any federal judge is held to a higher standard than the president. Because the president can be removed only for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, whereas a judge or justice can be removed for those reasons, but also for a lack of good behavior. Now, that sounded like a weird argument when it was being made, but when you think about it, there might be a reason why they'd impose a higher standard on judges, and that's that presidents serve four-year terms. And then, if the people don't like it, they can vote him out. A justice serves essentially a life term. As it says, good behavior, it doesn't say life, but that's practically what it means in most cases. And since we don't get a chance to periodically re-elect or defeat a judge or justice at the federal level, there may be reasons for saying there should be other grounds for their removal. We go on to read in Section 2 about the court's jurisdiction. And here we read that in a few types of cases, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. Cases involving ambassadors and a few other very unique cases like this. There the court has original jurisdiction. That is, they can hear a case that is brought directly in the Supreme Court. You don't have to mess around with going to the state courts first, or going to the federal district court first, and then appealing it up. You file your case directly with the Supreme Court. But those are only a few. For the majority of types of cases, in fact, the overwhelming majority, the court has appellate jurisdiction. That means that the court can hear a case only when it is brought up to the Supreme Court from a lower court. In all other such cases, the court has appellate jurisdiction with such exceptions and under such regulations as Congress may make. Now, there is a very important check that the framers placed in the Constitution, giving Congress the power to check the Supreme Court. Congress has the power to remove a particular subject from the court's appellate jurisdiction. For example, we have this issue about flag burning. And ever since 1989, with the Texas versus Johnson case, where the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said that the free speech clause of the First Amendment protects the right to burn a flag as symbolic speech or expression, and therefore Texas's law on flag desecration was invalid. Ever since then, we've seen proposals in Congress for a constitutional amendment that would prohibit flag desecration or would allow Congress or the states to prohibit it by legislation. And it seems each year it gets the necessary two-thirds of one house, but not the necessary two-thirds of the other, so it has never become law. Well, Congress could do that, but a simpler thing they could do if they saw fit would be to simply pass a statute that prohibits flag burning and then add a clause to the statute in which they say the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court over cases arising under this section or under similar state statutes is hereby rescinded, and the court then is out of the picture as far as flag burning is concerned. And some people say, well, that's interfering with the jurisdiction and authority of the court. No, it is exercising one of the checks and balances that the Founding Fathers wisely wrote into the Constitution. And they wouldn't have put it there had they not intended that it be used at least from time to time. By the way, one thing about impeachments and removals that we might mention here now that we're on the subject of the judiciary is that normally the President pro tem of the Senate would preside over a removal proceeding. I'm sorry, not the President pro tem. It would be the one who normally presides when he's able to. And who normally presides over the Senate proceedings? The Vice President. That's one of his main duties, is to preside over the Senate. But if we're talking about impeaching or removing the President, well, the Vice President is in a pretty conflicted position. On the one hand, he was elected on the same ticket as the President, and so there might be some loyalty there. On the other hand, he might be thinking, if we get rid of the President, I'm the next President. And so you can see what kind of a conflicting situation he's in. And so the Constitution very wisely provides that when the President is being considered for removal, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will preside over the Senate during that proceeding. Okay, the next thing we see here concerns treason. And I'm just going to ask you to notice something here as you see the language that is used. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against it, or in adhering to its enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Is that what it says? Did I mess up on a word there? What did I mess up? Doesn't say it for the United States. It says them. It doesn't say it. It says there. In other words, the framers thought of the United States at this time as sovereign states joined together in a unit. And if we were to make the sentence here, the United States blank going to war, what would be the missing verb? Are. The United States are going to war. Today, and since the days of the war between the states, we would more commonly say the United States is going to war. But that's not the way the framers understood it. As they saw it, we were going to war as states joined together in a common purpose, and commonly you would form up as Tennessee Regiment, an Alabama Regiment, an Ohio Regiment, and the like. And anyway, language sometimes reflects changes in thinking. And that's one case in which this shows the thinking of the time and how that thinking has changed. A couple of other things that we need to notice here is that the definition of treason consists of levying war against the United States or giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. And that's different from the way it was in England. In England, you could be considered a traitor just for harboring treasonous thoughts against the king. In America, and this was largely a Puritan idea, government had no jurisdiction over the conscience. The conscience was your sovereign dominion, and you could not be considered guilty of treason unless you had acted upon those treasonous thoughts, either by actions or by words. Another thing you'll note here is it further says that punishment for treason is not to consist of the corruption of blood. That doesn't mean injecting somebody with AIDS. Corruption of blood means depriving your descendants of their U.S. citizenship. And also that it must be established by at least two witnesses, again based on Deuteronomy 24:16 and other Old Testament and New Testament passages. In the mouth of two or three witnesses, let everything be established. Okay, we've got, now we end here at 7:15, is that correct? Is that right, 7:15? Okay, we've got only a little time here to go through a few articles, but let's look at Article 4, Relations Among the States. And one of the first is the Full Faith and Credit Clause. By this clause, each state normally must give full faith and credit to the legal acts done in another state. For example, if I make out a will, last will and testament for myself, in Alabama, to be valid in Alabama, a will requires the signature of two witnesses. But let's say that I go up to North Dakota, and let's say I freeze in a blizzard in North Dakota, maybe sometime around July or August, which is not likely to happen. Usually at that time the snow gets a little slushy. But so I die in North Dakota, and so they're trying to probate my will. Now, North Dakota requires three witnesses to a will. And let's say a judge said, well, this was made in Alabama, and it has only two witnesses. And the attorney who's probating my estate said, well, Your Honor, you see, that's an Alabama will, and Alabama only requires two witnesses. The judge might say, well, this isn't Alabama, this is North Dakota. Here we require three witnesses. The will is invalid. No, under the Full Faith and Credit Clause, that's not the way it works. Under that clause, a will that is valid where it is contracted will be accepted as valid anywhere. So if the will is valid where it was made in Alabama, then North Dakota must accept it as being valid for purposes of being probated up there. The same is true of other acts like marriage and divorce. Now, there is an exception to this, and the exception is if the law of one state violates the strongly held public policy of another state. Let's say, for example, that two people of the same sex join in marriage together, supposedly, in, shall we say, Massachusetts, and then they come down to Alabama, and they say, what Massachusetts hath joined together, let not Alabama put asunder. Does Alabama have to recognize a same-sex marriage from Massachusetts as valid? Probably not, although we don't know that for sure at this point. But the normal policy would be that if same-sex marriage violates the strongly held public policy of the other state, it does not have to give full faith and credit. And that's why you've seen many states in recent years passing marriage amendments in which they define marriage in a certain way, or in which they say it is the strongly held public policy of the state that marriage shall consist of, and so on. Then we have what's called the Privileges and Immunities Clause, that each state has to give to people of other states the same privileges that it extends to its own. For example, for those of you who like to hunt, let's say that somebody from Alabama comes up here and wants to go deer hunting. Does Tennessee have to give that person a deer hunting license? The answer is yes. They don't have to give licenses to anybody. They could prohibit deer hunting entirely. But if they allow deer hunting, they cannot restrict it to Tennessee residents alone. They have to allow Alabamans to apply for those licenses as well. Now, what they could do, they could charge a higher fee for Alabamans based on the fact that Tennessee people pay taxes that go to support wetlands and wild lands and so on. And since Alabamans don't pay that tax, it's fair that they might have to pay a higher license. That can be done. Same with resident versus non-resident tuition. Tennessee does not have to have any state universities. But if they have state universities, they have to let people from out of state attend those universities on the same basis of admission, at least, as people within the state. But because Tennesseans have been paying taxes to support their institutions, they could require people from other states to pay non-resident tuition, at least if that's reasonable. We also see here extradition. That each state, upon the request of the governor, must extradite to that state somebody who is being held for an offense. For example, let's say that Tennessee has filed murder charges against somebody who has fled the state and gone to Alabama. And let's say that person then is arrested in Alabama. The governor of Tennessee might submit an extradition request to the governor of Alabama asking that the person be sent back to Tennessee for trial. And according to the Constitution, the governor of Alabama must send it back. Now, there are a couple exceptions. One exception would be if the person is wanted on charges in Alabama, Alabama can go ahead and try him and can make him serve his sentence in Alabama and then send him back to Tennessee when he's done. Normally, if one state wants to assume the costs of prosecuting and housing a prisoner, the other state is very willing to accommodate. So usually there's not a problem. The other time there might be a problem is if the governor of one state has reason to believe that the person won't get a fair trial in the other state. Then he can refuse extradition. We had this situation in South Dakota with a couple of members of the American Indian Movement who were charged with murdering an FBI agent on the federal Indian reservation, and then they fled the state. And one of them, I believe it was Russell Means, was picked up on misdemeanor charges in California. At this time, the governor of South Dakota, a conservative Republican, asked that Means be extradited to South Dakota. The liberal Democrat, governor of California, said that Means would not receive a fair trial in South Dakota, and therefore he denied the extradition. Well, this made people in South Dakota pretty mad, and the governor of South Dakota then paroled several prisoners from the South Dakota State Penitentiary, and he announced that one of the conditions of their parole was that they had to establish residence in California. Well, Californians didn't like that very much, but there was nothing that they could do to prevent it. Okay, let's move on then. Article 5. There are a few things I'm skipping over because of the time factor here. Article 5 provides for amendments. And notice this statement by President Washington in his farewell address. If, in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. Notice that he's not saying that the Constitution is infallible. It may contain mistakes, or it may be that changed circumstances are going to require changes. But he says, let there be no change by usurpation. For though this, in one instance, be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. In other words, Washington recognized that it might be appropriate sometimes to amend the Constitution. That's how the Constitution is different from the Bible. It is not inspired and infallible in the way the Bible is. There are no provisions for amending the Bible, and there shouldn't be. But that being the case, we have two means by which the Constitution can be amended. The first, and most common, is by a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress. The amendment is passed, and then it is sent to the states to be ratified, and will become valid if ratified by three-fourths of the states, and they are to do so either in ratifying conventions or in the state legislatures, which is the more common way. And it's Congress who designates which way the states are going to use in deciding whether to ratify. But on the last several days of the Constitutional Convention, several delegates raised some concerns. And they said, what if the states want an amendment, but the Congress is not receptive to that amendment? Shouldn't there be another way they could amend the Constitution? And so in the last several days, they decided to put in another provision that said that if two-thirds of the state legislatures call for a new constitutional convention, then Congress shall call a convention. That convention will consider amendments. Whatever amendments they pass then will be sent to the states for ratification, just as they've been adopted by Congress. Now, we've never used that method. We've come very close sometimes. In fact, back in the 1980s, a balanced budget amendment came very close to getting the number of states necessary for a constitutional convention. Those of you who are good at math, what does it take? How many states to be two-thirds? Okay. We have 32 states call for a balanced budget amendment. And then a number of states started to rescind their calls. First state to do so, I believe, was Mississippi. Alabama tried to be first, but sometimes we're a little thick-headed in Alabama, and we forgot that we had called for a constitutional convention twice, and in our repeal of that call, we only repealed one of them, so we had to do it a second time to get it right, finally. But quite a few states repealed their calls for a convention. Personally, I think the balanced budget amendment was probably a good idea, but that a convention was not the way to do it, because we have no idea what would happen at a convention, whether or not they'd be limited to that amendment, whether they could consider other amendments, whether they could consider even a whole new constitution. Maybe as they're getting ready to adjourn, one delegate says, well, we're in session, I'd like to propose a school prayer amendment. Another said, yes, and I'd like to propose an affirmative action amendment. Another said, well, you know, last night there were a group of us got together in the bar, the basement of the hotel, and we drafted a whole new constitution, and we have it here on a hotel napkin, and we'd like to propose this. Could they do that? We don't know. All of that is ambiguous, and so I think that'd be a very dangerous step to follow. Well, we have two more amendments to consider, but both of them will be fairly short, so we will adjourn at this time, or at least I'll adjourn at this time. Where the rest of us go, I'm not sure, and we will resume this tomorrow, and we'll be able to do this, plus the constitutional amendments, within the last hour that we have devoted to this subject. So, appreciate your attention. Hope this has helped you to understand what the Constitution is all about, and I'll remind you once again, when all else fails, read the instruction book. The Constitution is the instruction book.